as something occurs to him, recording only one comment per card, with a card held vertically. Once he has written something down in black ink on the white card, he is free to move on to other considerations. It is, as he himself likes to say, a done deal. He writes on the cards anything he doesn't want to forget, either personal or professional. If I am not thinking about family, I am thinking about school. Something will come into my memory bank. Or maybe I'm trolling to see if there is anything that I ought to be doing, or I ought to have done, at home, or to set something up at school. Before it escapes him, he jots it down. The dean says he gets his ideas while walking through Washington Square Park, or when he's in a car going to an appointment. Sometimes an idea hits him in the middle of the night, or while shaving. It might be a thought about a major new direction for the school, something unusual, an inspiration. Wherever he is, a card is nearby. He grabs one and writes down the elusive thought. Or perhaps an idea is developing, and in conversation I'll get a cut on it I hadn't thought of before. Sometimes those ideas survive discussions with a colleague, and sometimes they don't. So what I will do then is write the idea on a card to make sure it survives. Sexton throws out the cards that have to do with appointments, or if it's just an information thing. Others he gives to the appropriate faculty member, or keeps on file until the job is done. For John Sexton, however, his system of index cards is dramatically more important than a running to-do list, easily dispersed and delegated. They are integral to his whole style of leadership. The dean has profound philosophical reflections on the part they play in his vision of community leadership at a great university and the whole notion of a leader. He calls it his aspirational mode. We have always understood culturally at some level the power of the word and the role of a leader to see things better than they are. Making it concrete actuates it. If you articulate something that is within the community's reach, but not yet actuated, the articulation of the goal can move the community toward that actuation. And the same is true of yourself. If you articulate a need, an opportunity, or a concept, you'll start your mind going through the various stages. It's not a question of getting the opportunities, he says with emphasis. It's a question of noticing that opportunities are there. Leadership depends on spelling out for others the opportunities that are there and on asking the questions. The job of the leader, he says, is to force the community to ask the right questions. You are never going to get answers or creativity if you don't ask the questions. Sexton is emphatic about this. I would put it this way. Another way of looking at the cards is that they create an agenda of questions that I am asking. I am not going to get answers unless I am asking the questions, and unless I am putting myself under the burden constantly to want to know why or how. The cards force me to constantly be in a different kind of conversation with the community of people here. That conversation is action-oriented, leading him continually to ask the questions that challenge, that push toward the possible. Collecting compliments. You can bank on it. As anyone knows who has ever had a collection, from bottle caps or baseball cards to rare coins or stamps, things seem to multiply when you have a place to put them. Before I ever published my first book, I went to the bank and opened an account called Best Seller for depositing book payments. I was nervous about doing that and felt silly at the time. It had a zero balance for a while. But because I had a place to deposit them, I soon found myself collecting those advances and royalty checks. Today it gives me great pleasure when I am selling books at a convention and a new fan asks, "To whom do I make out this check?" I grin from ear to ear and say proudly, "Make it out to the Best Seller account." Compliments are like money in the bank. They both give you a sense of security and they build up a nest egg you can draw upon in times of need. Designate a container to hold them, a place for them to go, and you will watch your deposits grow. With his usual good cheer and exuberance, Mark Aceto once showed me a tall, faded green antique accounting book he found unused in a second-hand bookstore. He told me he had fired his inner critic and hired a cheering squad instead. I decided to write down the names of all the people who have supported me in one way or another. I've got 210 names here, so far. He points to an early entry, Reaction to Younger Than Springtime. I was a freshman at Carnegie Mellon. The first time I ever sang in front of the class, a woman in the front row sighed. That's on the list of successes. It's a moment, a tiny moment. Because he has this book now to record them in, he keeps coming up with names, collecting compliments. My ear picks up on them more attentively. Somebody says something nice after a performance. A fan asks for my autograph. I get a flattering letter from a friend. I record it in my accounting book. I write down what people say about me. I put quote marks around the words, with their names at the bottom, just to remind me, to give again the boost I got when I first heard it. You don't have to be involved in the performing arts to track the kudos and compliments coming your way. I started one for myself and gave one to each of my children, challenging them to fill the book up with all the nice things people say about them. As Mark discovered, a compliment book can foil the critic, the inner voice that sows the seeds of doubt and despair. When you falter in your dream, consulting a compliment book reminds you of the character traits that others notice about you. Collectively, compliments are also signs and signals, go incidences. You have more strengths than you might realize you do, until you see them all together and notice the pattern of praise. Filling in the blanks. This whole book is about becoming a magnet, a receptor, an adventure going out to happen. When you arm yourself with a collection book, the magic seems to happen even more. That's why it can be a treat to fill in the blanks of a book fashioned along a definite theme. The blanks put you on the lookout for good things happening. Years ago, I ordered an opera journal from the Rizzoli bookstore catalog. It is a gem of a little book, very elegant, with Victorian pencil art, scrolls, and flourishes decorating its 300 gilt-edged pages. It charmed me to no end. Its small, clear sleeve, the Lilliputian pages, and the interesting separation of sections enchanted me. The first half of the 2¾ by 4¼-inch tiny tome is a subject index, a place to list performances and principles in alphabetical order. The second half is set off by a picture of cherubic angels holding up a sign that says, "Here the journal begins." This section boasts numbered pages, cross-referenced to the listings in front. A guide in gray type runs across the top of every page in the journal section, reminding you to include the essentials, the name of the opera, the date of the performance, and the place where you saw it. It was that last column that flummoxed me. Since moving to Seattle, the only place I ever went to the opera was right here. Indeed, we have a world-class opera company, and we do attract the top international voices. But I kept thinking how boring it would be to list only Seattle across the top of every page under place. Like Sir Edmund Hillary climbing Mount Everest because it was there, I set my cap to putting some variety in that last column because it was there. Soon after, my friend Nancy, at that time living in San Diego, invited me to come for a visit. I told her I wanted to come during the run of La Traviata, and she was delighted to buy tickets for herself as well as me. That performance marked the first different entry in the place column. A few weeks later, I was asked to give a workshop in New York. The company had 2 dates available. I checked the Metropolitan Opera schedule before deciding on the second date, which coincided with Rita Hunter singing Salome. This was fun. I made up my mind from that point on to arrange my New York engagements whenever possible around opening nights and debuts of my favorite singers. I extended my plan to other work-related travel. The blank lines in my little book were the mother of invention. I kept coming up with more and more ideas of how to fill that place column imaginatively. My editor for Writing on Both Sides of the Brain lived in Minneapolis. we needed to meet in person for the final in-depth editing. I scheduled the dates with him to parallel the Met in Minneapolis tour. By day, there were exciting yet intensive meetings with my editor. By night, I managed to attend 6 Metropolitan Operas in a row. Each night, I said, "Opera doesn't get any better than this," and the next night, it got better. I like to think the rhythm of the majestic music showed up between the lines in my work. My greatest coup was when I did a presentation in Cairo, Egypt, and managed to coordinate it around a spectacular Aida done outdoors in Luxor, in the desert. The backdrop was the temple of Queen Hatshepsut in the Valley of the Queens. Now that was a place worth recording. The opera journal from Rizzoli had taken on a life of its own, and filling in its blanks was changing my life. I started wondering about the alphabet part of the book. What else could I use it for besides organizing by name, titles of operas, artists, and composers? I decided it would be nifty to include autographs there. So I started a campaign to meet the stars backstage and get their signatures. At last count, I had 51 autographs, including such luminaries as Placido Domingo, Jerome Hines, Kiri Takenawa, Carol Vanness, and living composers such as Alan Hovhaness, Carlisle Floyd, and Daniel Catan. Now I need to order a new opera journal. This one is full. Full of fun and full of adventure and travels I never dreamed of when I first sent away for it. And that's what any or all of these suggestion boxes for the brain can do for your life, too. Whatever your particular suggestion box is, wheel book, tidbit journal, or index cards, keeping track on paper changes the conversation in your own head. It helps you to pay attention, to embellish your ideas, and record your inspirations. It pushes you toward the possible. Now you. 1. Get a small, pocket-sized memo book to write in. You don't have to be in a workshop or a new country to capture useful thoughts and notice life happening all around you. Portable pages prompt your brain to give you ways to move your goal along and encourage you to keep track of compliments, go incidences, and the signs and signals that you are on the right path. 2. For 1 week, substitute large index cards for the memo book. Write only one thought, one aha per card. Then note any other ideas surrounding that key one as they occur to you. At the end of the week, ask yourself, how is this different from other systems I've employed? Do I want to keep using it or go back to the other way? Did it add to the number of insights I had? Was it easier to sort and file? Continue with the modus operandi that works best for you. Switch off once in a while. 3. Find in the store or custom make a fill-in-the-blank book that reflects an interest of yours or one that you would like to develop. The applications are limitless. Hobbies, athletic events, investment data. And then watch what happens as you create ways to make entries. Motivated by an urge to fill in the blank spaces in a wine or cigar book, for example, you might find yourself trying out unusual labels and soon become a connoisseur. Or try this clever idea from a friend of mine who relocated to a new neighborhood and was having trouble making friends. She bought an address book and determined to fill it only with new acquaintances. Her book became a vehicle for meeting new people. Get a book like this for yourself, even if you haven't moved. Promise to enter only people not in any other address book you already own. Watch how fast it fills, and how rich in friendship your life becomes. When you have a suggestion box for your brain, you will find yourself living twice as much as you did before. 4. Getting ready to receive. There is a difference, says Napoleon Hill, between wishing for a thing and being ready to receive it. How do you discern the difference? How do you know when you are ready or if you are not ready? How do you know what it will take to get to that stage? Gloria's story is an inspiring example of preparing for a goal. Gloria's story. A man stands up in front of me and says, "Would you like to have a drink?" She looked at him, and then turned to the friend who was with her. "Should we?" Her friend whispered back, "I have to get home." So she said, "Stay for a couple of minutes." So he sat down. That was it. That's how I met him. I'm convinced that the angels whooshed him out of the chair. She is laughing now, because it was time. Gloria is describing to me, still with a sense of wonder and delight, the night she met the man who had become her husband. They started to talk. She liked his sense of humor and the way he dressed. The friend, who was in a hurry, asked him all the pertinent questions right off. So we knew his name was Ted, and we knew he was widowed for 3 years. We knew he had a 12-year-old child. We knew he was a lawyer. We knew all of this in under 10 minutes. Then he and I were sort of flirting, and my friend said, "I'm leaving. Is that okay?" And I said, "Fine," and she left us there. Gloria and I met at a workshop I was giving in New York City. She and Ted have been married for 16 years now, yet the recital of their coming together is as fresh as though it happened yesterday. A history like this doesn't go away and never gets old in the telling. It is a tender love story, and as much as anything else, it is a story of preparation and patience, an insight for those who ask, what does it mean to get ready to receive? They chatted for a while, and then he offered her a ride home. They were riding uptown from 45th Street and 2nd Avenue when Ted turned to her. "I think you might be the answer to my mother's prayers to St. Jude." "Excuse me, you're my mother's prayers to St. Anthony." And that was how they met. How the letters began. For 2 years, Gloria lived her life out of the conviction that this moment would come. She just didn't know when. Because what is unique about Gloria and Ted's story is that Gloria had been writing almost daily letters to Ted for 22 months before they met. How did the letters begin? When she was in her late 30s, Gloria found herself one night talking to a married friend of hers about how much she wanted to have a husband herself. It was my friend who told me then that when she was ready to have each of her children, she had written letters to a soul before the children were born to attract the kind of child she wanted. Gloria decided to adapt that idea to her own circumstances. She started to write what she calls her soulmate letters. Those letters precipitated a shift in Gloria's thinking. What writing those letters did for me was help me to feel how real it could be. Then I thought, if this is real, then it's just a matter of time. I just had to wait, and it would happen. From the very first letter, she shares candidly with her unknown companion. She also understands, on an intensely personal level, that readiness to receive entails a willingness to work at it. "Dear soulmate, my soul gets restless thinking that I might be alone in this life. My deeper feelings, when I am clear, help me to see that this is not true, that you are there for me if I feel my desire for you and am willing to lose my boundaries, willing to give over to another and not have such a neat existence. I am ever more in touch with my inner splits that keep us apart. As I acknowledge them, we come closer to being together. Do you see me in your heart also? Let us be together soon. Amen." Visualizing her desire. To further quote Hill, "No one is ready for a thing until he believes he can acquire it. The state of mind must be belief, not mere hope or wish." Gloria was sure, and she used her writing to help underscore that surety by visualizing in writing the qualities she desired in a partner. "If you know what you want, you can have it," says It Works. Gloria continually wrote out her visualizations of what would be for her the ideal partner, crystallizing her own concept of what she wanted in a mate. He would have, first, a love for life, and then, he is not afraid of strength or weakness in a woman. He admires it and nourishes it. "He will need me. He will need my vision and love of life. He will be grateful for my hopefulness. Together there will be nothing we can't do or be. We will stand together, yet separately, and will nourish each other. Gloria repeatedly wrote her picture of what her beloved would be like, his personality as well as his appearance. He has dark curly hair, blue eyes, an average build, a trim waist. He understands and is sympathetic to Italian family life. He likes short, red-haired women with good bodies. It scares her a little to be so specific, so she stops to defend it. Soulmate, I need to be concrete in this visualization, so that I do not shirk my real desire for you. Then she continues, my man will see me clearly and know my needs and wants. I will see him and know, really know, his needs and desires. We will laugh and play together. The more lucid your list of the conditions of satisfaction, the more easily the world can cooperate in giving you what you want. Soulmate, I see you again as medium height, strong, nice-looking, with curly hair, light eyes, strong hands, deep integrity, and spiritual truth, a businessman with a sense of security and knowledge about making and having money, not for its own sake, but for the joy, love, peace, and bounty it can bring the world. She is confident that they will share a deep inner connection, as well as enjoy some of the same outside activities. You will have a high energy level to accomplish tasks and yet be willing to relax and be lazy, to connect with yourself and me and our marriage together. You will have my interest in sports, music, dancing, art, spending time with friends. You will dress beautifully, comfortable in casual dress or evening wear, and want to enjoy life as I do. Sexuality and sensuality will be embraced by you. She imagines what life with him would be like. Every day I experience more clearly what it will be like being married to you. The sense of well-being and sharing, the love, the growth together. I see us with a warm, loving marriage and mutual respect and love to help our lives develop. How I long to share my life and be with you as your wife. May God grant us being together as soon as possible. Amen. Weeding out what isn't working. Ted and Gloria were married in February, 11 months after they met. It seemed almost too good to be true. Yet Gloria realized she had worked hard to be at this place, and she deserved it. In the process of writing it down, of visualizing, there is a constant surrender, a constant working on the issues that keep you from your fulfillment. It's not only about writing things down. There is a parallel course. There is work that has to be done. Gloria was insightful enough to know that events happening or not happening outside us are often merely a reflection of our own inner struggle. Dear soulmate, my task lately has been to get rid of old ghosts. Before I can be free to be with you, I need to let go of the past. That is what scares me now. I'm in the abyss, that in-between state of then and now. The major preparation has been to acknowledge how afraid I am to love you in your physical being. You can see how I create distractions not to be with you. My soul longs for and fears the intimacy we can have together. The answer for Gloria was an act of continuous relinquishment. Dear soulmate, I haven't spoken to you directly for a while. I have been placing my wish in our Father's hands, awaiting their fulfillment. I continue to work on the inner surrender and trust needed to challenge my no to life and convert it to a yes. I commit to more prayer, meditation, and space to allow the inner work to evolve. She welcomed the challenge, and at the same time acknowledged the frustration. There were days when she did not feel like going out. I'm in hiding, soulmate. Today and yesterday were difficult. It's the feeling that I'll never find you, that God plans for us not to meet, which is absurd since I don't know what God intends. I can only have faith. But today I felt I could attack any man who passed me. I felt so desperate. When I feel that way, I want to lay low and hide. You understand, of course, that I'm not hiding from you. I do so want you in my life. This morning and last night, I felt so alone, and I so wanted your presence. I need holding and sharing. You will bring me these things, and I hate waiting for them. I want you now, but I know it does no good to demand. About a month before she met Ted, Gloria hit her lowest level of despondency. She met a man whom she knew in her heart was not going to be the one, yet she was still disheartened that she did not connect with him. I was so discouraged in that moment. How many more men will I have to meet before this is possible? I was ranting and raving. How many more? Because of her writing, though, her disillusionment did not last months or even days. It lasted 20 minutes, and she went past it. It was like a nightmare. It was horrible, and I cried, and it seemed like I was in the depths of despair, and right behind it was my faith again. I always came back to the place of saying, "This is possible." And then she went back once more to writing. "Dear soulmate, my heart of hearts knows I need solid love, friendship, and patience as I wait for you. Please come home soon." A birthday wish. After writing her letters for a year, Gloria announced her target date on New Year's Eve. "Dear soulmate, this is an important year for us. I expect us to be together by my 40th birthday. I've asked our Father to grant me this birthday wish. I am nourishing my complete faith that our time has come. I am ready for you. Demanding doesn't work. Faith will bring us together. I gently wait for you. I will lead my life, be open, and you will appear before me. So please come home to me, and let's start our life together. Yes, this 40th year. By my birthday, please. I love what we will have together, soulmate, and look forward to our lives." Then, a week before her birthday, she dares for the first time to add "husband" to the salutation. "Dear soulmate and husband, I believe we will be together soon. I've been preparing for your coming now for many years." And she outright invites him to come to her party, telling him the date, time, and place. "I do so want you here for my birthday party next Saturday, April 9th, at 8 p.m. He didn't come. Apparently, Gloria needed more preparation, more patience. The letters that follow accept that reality, while refusing to interpret his not showing up to mean that he wasn't coming at all, only that it would take longer. "I pray that your preparations to be with me and my preparations to be with you coincide soon. Amen." Being whole. In the Chinese philosophy of feng shui, the harmony of our outer surroundings reflects our inner balance. In preparing for meeting Ted, Gloria found herself streamlining the spaces where she worked and lived. She consciously made the decision to live a full life, whether she was married or not. Now, with that, there was always a desire to be married, but I had to look at my life and say, "If you never married, what would it look like?" In a significant and empowering move, Gloria decided she did not have to be married to have fine china, so she began collecting Royal Doulton and got place settings as gifts. Then she started hosting holiday dinners in her apartment, rather than always being the guest at family functions. Far from giving up, it was more a matter of living a quality life. And as she took each of these validating steps, she shared them with her beloved. "I'm becoming so much of who I am. My love, my need, and my desires are all right at the surface. My humor is improving, and you should see my watercolors. I am living as fully as I can and await your presence and my new task as wife. I am becoming the woman you would want me to be, at least the woman I would want to be for you. I am learning to live with me so I can live with you. May we be together soon. Love to you." Even as she continued to prepare for her bridegroom, Gloria was aware that there were dividends to herself as well. "I've told you often that I was preparing myself for us to be together. I needed to feel my autonomy and zest for life again before we could be together. I have learned much in this last year that's been vital to our coming together. The most important lesson is to know that if we aren't together for years, that I will be just fine. My survival doesn't depend on us being together, but it will be a bonus and reward in life, a specialness. Can it be different? Gloria was buying fine china, watercolor painting, decluttering, and decorating. She had a powerful, high-paying job, friends, and travel, and she continued to use her writing as a means of discovery and growth. What were the issues in her life that prevented him from making his appearance? Originally, the thought of disagreements in marriage frightened her. It was worrisome to see the marriages around her, the fighting between couples, the passion turned to ennui. Dear soulmate and husband, my no still clings to bad marriage, unhappiness, people who divorce, some of my married friends' constant conflict and discontent, not focusing on positive role models. Yes, if truth is known, I do not envy those friends whose marriages are difficult and they have no desire to change. The more she wrote out her fear, the more she realized that, ironically, this dread was keeping her from experiencing the intimacy she desired. What has kept us apart is my fear. My fear that we will fight, get on each other's nerves, feel crowded and demanded of, lose our desire for sex together, and take less of life. But ultimately, my fear is of drudgery and hate in marriage. I hold up those marriages that seem the most difficult as what I will get. She asks her soulmate a heartfelt question. Can it be different for me? And tentatively begins to explore the ways in which her approach to relationships already sets her apart. I do give a lot to loving and working on relationships. I do trust my channel to truth and honesty, which many people do not bring to their relationships. This is the area on which I can build my hope, my commitment to loving and commitment to truth. These are the ways I am different from the bad relationships. Poignantly, a picnic with friends and family opened her eyes. In a deeply felt, touching description, she shares with her beloved the scene and describes its meaning for her. Today I spent the day with several families with lots of children. It warmed my heart to see people as they really are, not idealized into perfect children, perfect parents, or perfect couples. Just people, my friends, who struggle to love, accept, and be in God's world. It is this aspect of acceptance that I want to bring to our marriage. I long to be with you to start our life together. I've particularly cleared some deep misconceptions in the last weeks, especially acknowledging my belief that no marriage can work or be fulfilling. It is these beliefs that I challenge over and over today, visualizing their meeting. Gloria continued to visualize in writing what he would look like and even how they would meet. We can meet as part of my everyday life, and we will see each other and know we will be together. God's work will manifest almost immediately. The joy and movement that will follow will reinforce God's abundance. She pictured herself walking into a room and encountering him for the first time. Soulmate, you will be sitting, chatting with someone over an exciting new idea. You will recognize me as I will recognize you, and our importance in each other's lives. We will talk and instantly start a friendship. We will feel the attraction. I will recognize you by your looks and your eyes. Your eyes will reflect a sparkle, a fun, a humor about life, and a knowing. Her final picture is so sure and confident, it spills over into a litany of affirmation. Our married life will blend with each of our family obligations, and we will start our life together. We will be open to what life will give us, and willing to work at loving and living. With this commitment, everything will be easy. There will be a tentative and then resounding yes. Marriage, family, money. Yes. Loving, life tasks. Yes. Prayer, meditation, giving. Yes. Amen. 2 weeks after writing this last visualization, in her everyday life, Gloria went after work to a pub with a friend who was in a hurry. A dark-haired man of average build was in a corner chatting with business friends. He looked over at Gloria, caught her eye, stood up, walked over, and offered to buy her a drink. The first thing she noticed about him was the sparkle in his eyes. Now you. 1. Writing a full-fledged description of what you want is one way of saying you believe that it's attainable and you are ready to receive it. The more precise you can be, the more ready you are. Write a visualization in loving detail, not only depicting your goal, but rehearsing what the particulars of your daily life will be like once this goal is realized. 2. If, like Gloria, your goal is to find a loving partner, follow her lead and write letters to him or her. As her married friend found, you can also write letters to your children before they are conceived. Keep in mind how Gloria put it. What writing those letters did for me was help me to feel how real it could be. 3. When things are not happening as fast as you would like, ask, through your writing, what more do I have to learn? What is the lesson here for me? What is the waiting teaching me? Let your pen answer your ponderings. Gloria's words sum it up. Then, I thought, if this is real, then it's just a matter of time. I just had to wait, and it would happen. 5. Addressing fears and feelings. When you write down your goals, your fears of why they won't work, or even the consequences of what might happen if they do work, often come crashing in on you. The voices of, but what if, and what if, make a cacophony of sound inside your head, drowning out your dreams. This chorus of concerns can slow down your plans, or sometimes stop them altogether. My friend Janine's experience taught me a lesson about how to handle such fears and feelings. Janine and I met through her course, Planning Your Trip to France, which I took the year I went to Paris to celebrate the publication of my first book. In this travel class, Janine teaches what to pack and not to pack, how to get around, and what wines are best to buy. She uses a slideshow to illustrate the highlights of the major cities and the countryside, gives travelers an insight into French customs, and enough Gaelic phrases to get around. What Janine never mentions in the class is how she got to be so first-hand knowledgeable about France to begin with. It is a story that changed her life. Janine's story. While in her late 20s, Janine went on a, if this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium, type tour of Europe. She covered 9 countries in 18 days. It was a whirlwind that whet her appetite to return in earnest for a longer stay and immerse herself in the language and culture of a particular country. Easier said than done. She had close connections with her friends, no savings, house payments. In addition, she knew it would be difficult to find employment if she left the job she had. Her hard-to-snag teaching position would not wait for her while she expanded her horizons. Mainly, it would cost more money than she even had to pull it off. At 2:30 a.m. on a January 1st, only 2.5 hours into the new year, on the front page of a spanking new journal she had received as a Christmas gift, Janine noted that resolutions, big and small, long-term and short-term, observable and fantasy, were darting through her mind. She listed them in random order. 1. To learn French fluently and enough German to get by. 2. To make and follow through definitely on plans to live and travel internationally. 3. To write a will. 4. To appreciate my friends more. 5. To learn something about plumbing. 6. To lose weight and maintain it. Perhaps subconsciously aware that she had put protective padding of at least 8 throat-clearing, courage-gathering, totally unnecessary words around number 2, her scariest ambition, she repeated it, uncovered starkly, centered clearly and unnumbered, at the bottom of the page. I want to go live in Europe and travel in Europe. Looking back on it now, she realizes that writing it out like that was the beginning, although she never knew at the time where it would take her. I didn't have it well formed. I just knew I wanted to go back for a long period of time, at least a year. The fact that her goal to live in Europe, to travel in Europe, was on the first page of her journal, helped keep the dream alive. Her eye fell on it every time she sat down to make an entry. Throughout the months that followed, her journal jottings reflect her steadfastness in the face of ambiguity. Her resolutions page was a beacon she went back to time and again. Life is a decision. Janine shared her journal of that life-changing year with me and gave me permission to quote from it. That was an amazing gift. When I read the journal in toto for the 3/4 of a year leading up to her trip, I was reminded, over and over, of an important axiom. Life is a decision. At any point in your life, you can decide to act one way in spite of feelings urging you to go in the other direction. When you believe in a dream, you need to risk. You could wind up waiting forever if you wait until everything looks easy. You could wind up permanently living in what motivational speaker Bob Moad calls that great vacation spot, Someday Isle. People do that their whole lives, says Janine, waiting until this, whatever, happens before that, whatever, can take place. In her journal following that first entry, she talks about her discouragement. Things do not automatically fall into place just because she wrote it down. No, no, never. Life doesn't work that way. People let frustrations cloud their dreams, and they give up too easily. They don't believe their dreams will happen. There were many times when an extended trip outside of the country looked impossible. She often thought her goal was grandiose, unattainable, irresponsible even. When Janine had those moments of feeling discouraged and depressed, she kept on writing. She wrote out how she felt. I am depressed and tired and worried about the future. I am not sleeping well. The last 2 nights, I have awakened at 2:30 and stayed awake to 3:30 or so. Ticker tapes of woulda, coulda, shoulda go through my head. A good weekend, but I've been continually uptight and distraught. I don't quite trust myself. I often feel like a large human pinball, spronging off one wall after another in a small room. I feel grouchy, insecure, introverted. My goal's getting fuzzy. Desperation hangs on my back like a wet towel. A place to park her worries. Her most pressing worry was money. Why leave something secure for the unknown? I must remind myself often of the meaning of leave without pay. That scares me. Her journal became a place to park her worries. Writing out her fears spared her either-or thinking. Fears and ambition could coexist. Interspersed with her declarations of depression and discouragement, sometimes on the same day, she made steps so subtle she did not even see them as consequential. The line, live and travel internationally, was the constant as she bobbed up and down on a sea of emotions. In spite of her fear and uncertainty, she kept doing little things. Called Western University registration today to see about transferring overseas credits and get the paperwork rolling just in case. Highline Community College is offering a refresher course in Italian and French on Monday nights. I called to sign up. Pat, pat, pat on the back. I bought an Olympus OM-1 for my trip. $150 for body and lens. She imposed deadlines on herself and kept to them. My bottom line for deciding the fall plan must be June. It would give me 2 months to organize. Also, fees for the fall semester must be in by then. Filled out forms for Avignon study. Enrolled in a program for credit at Faculté de Lettres. Getting in shape. Running. Working on paring down gotta-dos. Writing made her feelings speed bumps, not roadblocks. Feelings might slow down her pace, but not stand in her way. Janine knew if she kept on heading in the right direction, she would eventually arrive at her destination. Writing keeps it separate. For Janine, writing down her apprehensions was a way of distancing herself, standing on the outside of her concerns, to become an observer of her own life, a court reporter, noting the facts, not being swayed by them. Left unexpressed, her concerns could have grown and overpowered her resolve. Writing them down became a way to vent and move on. On paper, she could talk herself out of her fears. This stage fright is part of the process of anything new and difficult. I will never get anywhere if I don't risk. This is a great test in letting go of fear, being myself, and trusting. The big picture. Writing down her fears set another element in motion, one which Janine herself was unaware of. Synchronicity was happening all around her. The world was cooperating. Looking back at her whole journal reveals the pattern. Circumstance conspired from January through September to get her out the door and onto another continent. One by one, her fears seemed to eliminate themselves. Saying on paper how she felt and what she was afraid of propelled her to action and propelled the world into action on her behalf. Yet, her biggest fear was lack of money. I had no guarantee of a job, no hope of a job on my return because of the budget crunch and all the layoffs going on. But my desire to go to Europe became overwhelming. So she filed her application for a leave of absence. In response to her formal request, Janine received a phone call from the personnel director. On the day that he called, she was feeling downhearted. Had she jumped the gun and made a foolish choice? The director said, "Janine, I want to talk to you about your leave application." She was sure he was going to turn her down and terminate her employment. She was astonished when, instead of firing her, he told her that since she wanted to go to France and study language, she qualified for a sabbatical. He told her the district had two or three available. Janine had never thought about applying for a sabbatical. I was a young teacher in my early 30s. I thought, nah, sabbaticals were for teachers who had seniority. I also thought they needed to be more research-based, and this wasn't a research trip. It was an experiential trip. Studying a foreign language is what tipped him. The director sent the paperwork, and Janine filled it out, and the school district granted her a sabbatical, not a leave. This was a great boon. A magical door opening wide, because it meant Janine would be paid to travel and study abroad. Back in those days, my take-home salary was $1,600 a month. I was guaranteed $800 a month for the full year to travel, plus medical, a big plus. The catch, which was a relief rather than a restriction, was that she had to agree to teach when she got back. One of the requirements of the sabbatical was a 2-year commitment to the classroom on her return. Since I had been laid off and rehired for 5 years in a row and had no guarantee of a job at all, the promise to teach for 2 years was just fine with me. Bon voyage. So in September, instead of heading back to the classroom, Janine was aboard Alitalia heading for Milan, and from there on to Paris. After visiting some friends in Cembra in the Dolomite Mountains, she went to Paris, where she connected with a group who were also going to Faculté de Lettres to study. In Avignon, her sabbatical stipend paid for living with a French woman for several months while she earned 45 credits. The woman, in her 60s, became like a mother to her. I lived in a farmhouse where people in the resistance had rescued and hid others during the war. I took courses in medieval French, language, French women writers, French history, French culture, French politics. Most of the classes were in English, but the cooking classes were in French, which was wonderful. I took an aerobics class, which was taught in French, and I was the only American in the class, so my language skills got to work out too. After her studies in Avignon ended, she traveled around Europe and Asia by train and by boat, visiting 10 countries. A tower of events. That trip changed Janine's life. Janine could not have anticipated all the things that took place in her life as a direct result of the trip. Many events of the next 15 years were because of what she did in that 1 year, and it hasn't stopped yet. Janine calls it the Lego effect, a tower of other interlocking events built upon that single sabbatical. The first trip overseas seemed impossible until she did it. She has been back almost every year since, partly because her trip changed her teaching. Before, she was a social studies teacher. When she came back from sabbatical, she became a French teacher. Several years in a row, she took kids to France over spring break. She ended up going back to France 10 times, so far, taking friends or students, or going by herself. The 45 credits from Avignon applied to her salary steps, so it moved her up a pay grade. As part of her sabbatical, Jeanine prepared a slideshow and a lecture for the schools, and used that as the basis to develop her travel class. In addition, Jeanine was so taken with her studies of France in the 15th century, she decided to write a novel based on the life of Joan of Arc and her contemporary, the medieval poet Christine de Pizan. The fabricated parts of the story are interwoven with Christine's actual poetry and true facts about Christine's life, as well as an historically correct depiction of the political intrigue and customs of the medieval times. Visiting the sites in person made it easier for Jeanine to describe them in detail and get a feel for the power of the places she was writing about. That book is now part of a trilogy of novels Jeanine is writing based on French medieval history. See how one adventure builds on another? How doors open upon more doors to explore what's behind? Jeanine took a leap of faith when she turned in the application for the leave of absence. And look what happened. She not only kept her job, she had it guaranteed for 2 years and received an increase in salary. She became a French teacher and returned to France 10 times. She wrote an historic novel based on her studies and has taught travel classes for over 10 years now. The impact that trip had on her life was well worth overcoming her initial fears. Why write down fears? I asked Jeanine why she thinks writing down her fears about going to Europe made a difference. Writing down your fears, she explained, takes negativity and anxiety out of the gut. The only thing it creates there is indigestion. A line in her journal sums up this principle. Writing is a good way to force my negative emotional reactions into words and not stomach churnings. What made the difference about writing it down? I was discouraged, and if I hadn't written it down, I wouldn't have applied for the leave of absence, and I never would have thought in a million years about a sabbatical. Without writing it down, I wouldn't have had the courage to leave my job. Every time I opened that journal, I looked back and there it was, to live and travel internationally. It was always alive, because it was right there on that page. As I made plans and thought about it, I wrote about the plans in that same journal, and if I got discouraged, I would write about that and write through the discouragement. Jeanine would go into the writing feeling negative and come out of the writing remembering that there is a lot of joy in traveling. So I wrote about the joy. Just because I didn't have any money and was going to give up my job, that didn't mean that it shouldn't happen. A lot of people would consider either one of those two factors enough to stop them. Not Jeanine. She conquered her fears by writing them down. The lesson is to let your writing be a place to park your worries. If you write down your fears as well as your dreams, you start yourself on a path, and something's going to open up and make that path a little less rocky. Now you. 1. When you wrote down your major goals at the end of Chapter 1, did you find fears encroaching on your territory almost immediately? Here's a chance to dispel them. Don't leave them inside your head. Write them down. Writing separates the dream from the fear. Writing about your anxiety makes it an entity existing outside of your goal. Jeanine's plan to go to Europe and her lack of money could coexist. The desire to study abroad and the worry about losing friends sat side by side. Writing down her worries made them matter of fact. The fact, on one hand, need not negate the dream on the other. Write down your fears and take the churning out of them. 2. Find a magazine picture of someone yelling, maybe at a protest rally or on a picket line, or a mean-looking authority figure. Hands on hips, self-righteous, smug, superior. Paste this picture on your fears page. Write fast and furiously a litany of laments, the sweeping character judgments, the in-your-face carping, the nagging, mean-spirited put-downs. Use the second person and be pejorative. You're not good enough. You'll never make it. It's morally wrong to have too much money. Fame is dangerous. You are not talented enough. You'll take a pay cut. You'll lose prestige. You'll fail. Now find a picture of somebody jubilant, hands in the air, open to life, rejoicing, jumping up and down. A yes face. Maybe a power fist salute and great glee. A big, just won the Olympic smile. This is your hooray page. One by one, turn each and every statement on the fears page into a first-person, present-tense affirmation. I am the best. I am successful. My paycheck is soaring. I am a sought-after expert, admired by my colleagues. I am fearless. I am focused. What I offer is special. I use time wisely and well. When I get out of balance, I find my way back. My family and friends take pride in my success. I am rich and famous. Writing down your fears takes away their hold on you. Writing out the reverse of your fears and upping the ante, making the opposite statement not just the fear in reverse, but something even more attractive, empowers and energizes you to start thinking differently, to attract the kind of answers that, rather than keep you tied down, go with a world view of solutions. 6. Getting unstuck. Writing through to resolution. It was, as our log-cabined Chamber of Commerce likes to call it, an Edmonds kind of day. A day when the water sparkles down at Brackett Beach and the Olympic Mountains across the Sound are so crisp they look like white-topped ice cream sundaes ready to eat. The kind of day when the water is dotted with sailboats because everyone wants to take advantage of blue skies, fair winds, and a following sea. My triathlon-level super jock brother had a different idea. A perfect day for running, he announced jubilantly. He had been promising for some time to take his two non-athletic sisters out and teach us a trotting trick or two. Today was the day. He put on his Nikes, we put on our Keds, and together we headed out the door to pound the pavement. Running alongside us, he started us out at a moderate speed, then built up momentum. Soon he was yelling like a drill instructor whipping a platoon of scruffy recruits into shape. See that Volkswagen? He bellowed, pointing to a red VW some 2 blocks distant. You see that Volkswagen? You own that Volkswagen. Go for it! Go for it! Puff, puff. The Volkswagen. Run for the Volkswagen. Totally focused, single-minded, heading for the parked car. We ran and we ran. And then, as we neared the red bug, before we could stop, touch the fender, and claim completion, he switched landmarks. Forget the Volkswagen. See that hill? You own that hill. Go for it. Go, go, go. Keep on going. Puff, puff. The hill, the hill. Run for the hill. Once more, the destination changed as soon as we got near it. We continued to run. He continued to target, over and over, ever new, ever farther points. By the end of that morning, we were ready for fratricide. But we had to admit, it did, in fact, get easier as we went along. And we had never run as far in our lives as we ran that day. When I am stuck, not knowing what to do next to bring my dreams to reality, I use a technique I call writing through to resolution. My brother's moving markers on that day of running has become a metaphor for me to write and write, covering as much ground as possible, until up pops an answer. First I put on my mental Keds and write something, anything, to get the pen moving, to set words down on paper, even if what I write is, I don't know what to write. When I get toward the bottom of the first page and start to slow down, I challenge myself to go to the bottom of the next page. You own that page, I exhort myself. Cover it. Cover it. Keep on writing. In Tai Chi, this practice is called extending Chi. When you train your focus on something beyond your original bullseye, or what you thought was the extent of your capabilities. This is how the martial arts master slices through a block of wood with the side of her hand, by concentrating her energies on something beyond the block. Owning first the VW, then the hill, covering that page, then the next,